I guess as there are people here from the conference that's going on entangled states, which I will say something about, and then to the remainder of the audience, I'll try to give you a flavor of the whole field. So let me begin by just mentioning a few of the collaborators on the things I'll mention today, several of whom are in the audience. Rob Myers, I don't know if Ajay is here, William, who just spoke, Devanjan, and Aris, and I'll mention work with them as I go along. So my intention here is to actually focus on three different experiments to illustrate some simple ideas that are being discussed in the conference, for example. But of course, these are experiments that are closer to my own personal interests. So we have a very successful theory of states of matter, which is in all the textbooks, and it's built on two important principles. One principle is the one of adiabatic continuity from the independent particle state. And this, of course, goes back to the very beginnings of quantum mechanics, where we started to think of metals as just a bunch of free electrons occupying some states in the bands of a periodic potential. So the electrons have strong interactions with each other, but nevertheless, the metallic state that you get, which we call a Fermi liquid, is smoothly connected to the free electron states. And apart from various renormalization, the basic structure has not changed. And the same ideas then extend with small variations to insulators and superconductors and magnets and many other phases of matter that we study and understand very well. The second important principle describes the excited states of some state of matter, and that's the idea of quasi-particles. So if I take a metal and I heat it up a little bit, I'll create excitations above the Fermi level, excitations below the Fermi level, and again, I can think of these excitations as some renormalized set of particles that behave almost like free electrons or free holes. I plug them into some transport equation like the Boltzmann equation, and this has been an incredibly successful paradigm for almost everything in condensed matter physics. Okay, but in the past 20 years or so, I think interest has turned to systems in which one or both of these paradigms fail. So we're interested in, very loosely speaking, phases that are not adiabatically connected to the independent particle states. And so they have some sort of non-trivial many-body structure where you can't write down the wave function as a product or connect it to a wave function which is a product. And I just loosely refer to it as many-particle entanglement. There are more precise definitions that I won't go into. But the second also important idea is that many of these complicated states nevertheless do have a quasi-particle description. That is, you can get a simple description of low-energy dynamics, except that the quasi-particles are not electrons. They are other more exotic objects, which we give them various names, but they're not the electron themselves or composites of an electron. So you can imagine even more complicated states where there are no quasi-particles at all. And most of my talk, if I time it right, will be on case B, but let me just mention one important example from experiments in case A. At least we believe that it's in this class, because this is also a case that's been discussed extensively in this meeting. So the experiment I want to just briefly describe is this experiment on this compound called Herbert-Smithite. And this is a beautiful experiment by Young Lee's group at MIT, who after much labor managed to grow a single crystal of this compound. And the innards of this compound, it's an insulator, and the important structure is this net of blue atoms. These are copper atoms that sit on the vertices of a Kagame lattice. And so he sends in neutrons, flips a spin on the copper site, and measures at the cross-section for absorbing energy omega with momentum transfer Q in this layer. So when you do that, in contrast to almost any other magnet or insulator you might study, you get this very diffuse pattern. So at a given energy, this is a cross-section at two coordinates of two momenta at a fixed energy, you get broad scattering at a whole range of momenta. And so this tells you that there is no sharp excitation with a very definite energy-momentum relation, as might be expected in a conventionally ordered magnet. And this evolves in an interesting way as a function of energy and momentum. So this is one indication of the existence of what are called spin-ons. And many of us are trying to think about and really in detail understand the structure of the scattering. Now, many years ago, I had written down a trial state for the Kagame antiferromagnet, now called a Z2 spin liquid. And those days, we didn't have color printers, so this is the best plot I made of the structure factor. Fortunately, my postdoc took pity on me and created a color plot and in the modern colors. And you can see it actually does reasonably well. One of the states that I had in this paper does reasonably well in capturing the momentum state structure, including these peaks, which also appear here if you look at them carefully. But the many details of the underlying neutron scattering experiments are not well understood. But let me just step back a bit and just give you a very crude picture of what we think might be going on. So here's the Kagome net of the copper spins. There's essentially one electron per copper site. And if these were classical spins, they'd form some sort of ordered structures like the one shown here. But what we believe is that the spins, they form spin singlets in what's called a resonating valence bond liquid proposed by Anderson. So each spin can form a singlet with just one other spin, and so they're, in a sense, entangled with each other. But the idea of the resonating valence bond liquid is that you have further resonance or entanglement between the valence bond themselves. So the actual wave function is a superposition of many of these configurations. So that's the ground state, or something like it, that we believe is present in this Herbert-Smithite crystal. And what's one of the interesting things about this ground state, in the case of the Z2 spin liquid, is that we have some understanding of the basic excitations. So these are quasi-particle excitations. So they can move around, but they don't carry the right quantum numbers. So here's an excitation called a spin-on. We have one unpaired spin, and in this resonating valence bond liquid, it would move just carrying spin a half, but no charge. But this liquid also has another type of excitation, often called a vison. And the way to think about it is you take any plaquette of the lattice and draw a branch cut from the plaquette out to infinity. And you basically impose a vortex-like structure around that point. This means that every time a valence bond crosses this branch cut, the wave function in that component of the wave function picks up a minus one. So the wave function is a superposition of an infinite number of terms, but you're going to change the sign of a few of them in a clever way to get something that's orthogonal to the ground state. So in this configuration, you won't change the sign. This one has two cuttings, so you change the sign. You wouldn't, because it's again two and so on. So this is another excitation which has a life of its own. It doesn't carry spin or charge, but it has interesting statistical properties when you exchange it with when you take a vison around it. And these are excitations that we think, if this theory is right, should eventually explain the structure factor that's seen in the experiments. So what's happening now is that the neutron comes in and it creates not just one of these excitations, but a large number of them in principle. It has to create at least two spin-ons and create more visons. And that complicated physical process, what we need to understand the details of the dynamic structure factor that's been observed by Young Li's group. So in particular, there seem to be some directions in momentum where things are it's quite momentum independent. This is the energy axis. Other directions, they are very momentum dependent. The simplest models we've made of this kind of structure, plotted in a slightly different scheme, don't quite work. But we're now thinking hard about other higher order contributions that could perhaps explain the experiments at lower energies. So anyway, this is a work in progress, but combined with also some very nice numerical work on the Kagome system, we're approaching, I think we're close to some eventual understanding of this experimental system. All right, so then I'm going to turn to the main part of my talk, which are more complicated entangled states, which don't have the benefit of being described by these simple quasi-particles that you can just write down and understand how they move around. In fact, we don't have really a good language for thinking about how we think about the dynamics and interaction at finite temperature of systems whose excitations don't have a particle-like character or cannot be written as composites of other particles. So I'm going to talk about two experiments. One is the superfluid insulated transition of ultra-cold atoms in optical lattices. And the second is I'm going to sneak in some ideas on high-temperature superconductivity, where we're a long way from a complete theory, but there's been a lot of, I think, interesting experimental progress in the last year or two that I want to highlight. All right, but let me talk about this cold atom system for now. Okay, so here's the basic system we have in mind. We have bosons, in this case, rubidium atoms at very, very low temperatures, which are subjected to a periodic potential by interfering beams of laser light. When the periodic potential is very deep, the bosons get trapped in the wells of the potential, one each, for example, as in this picture. And this is a state that is an insulator, because if you try to tilt this, the potential, the bosons wouldn't flow. On the other hand, if the potential is weak, well, these are bosons at low temperature, and bosons at low temperature always both condense. So you'll get a superfluid state in which, if you tilted the system, you'd get easy flow of bosons. So it turns out there's a critical depth at which you have a very sharp transition at zero temperature between the insulator and the superfluid. And this is the transition that theoretically and experimentally we've been trying to understand. So there's a very recent experiment by the group of Emmanuel Bloch, where they took the system in two dimensions. And it's a fairly large system with on the order of 1,000 atoms in the center, which is in a flat periodic potential. And they just shook it. So you take the system, and then you shake the bottom of the whole thing collectively at some frequency. You shake it for a while, and then you do some, you do some tricks to allow you to measure the temperature of the system after you shook it. So it's really a very simple experiment in principle. Just shake it, and you ask how hot does the system become. So this is their data. So they work at different depths of the potential. So let's focus on one particular depth, and you shake it with this frequency nu. You notice this is only hundreds of hertz, so this is a very low energy scale. You shake it at these low frequencies, and you see hardly any change in the temperature. But then around 400 hertz, you see this threshold where the temperature rises. So you note this frequency at which you had the threshold. Then you change the depth of the potential and do it again. You note the frequency. And then you put it all together, and you plot this frequency nu naught as a function of the depth of the potential. So this measurement is actually being done in the superfluid phase. So here the potential is very weak, that's very shallow, and so you have a very good superfluid, and this frequency is actually quite high. And what you notice is that as you approach the insulator, this frequency goes down, seems to vanish at this critical frequency, and then comes back up again on the other side. So I'm especially interested in the nature of this critical point, and also using our understanding of that critical point to understand this data and how it comes down and what is the meaning of this threshold. Okay, so I'm going to introduce some theory now to try to describe this basic experiment. Okay. So here's a theory's phase diagram. You're tuning some parameter. I have now put the superfluid on the left rather than the right. Sorry about that. This we view as the depth of the periodic potential. This is the critical point where there's a phase transition. So now the superfluid side, you have an order parameter, the Bose condensate. So you define it, introduce a complex field, which is the condensate wave function of the boson, and this has a non-zero value in the superfluid. And in the insulator, then, of course, this is zero. So to understand this transition, we want to write down some effective theory or some Lagrangian for the dynamics of this complex field psi. And it turns out that the theory is actually a very familiar theory to field theories, just the usual Seifert field theory, a bunch of harmonic oscillator at each momentum with a nonlinear self-coupling that you need to stabilize it when the frequency of the harmonic oscillator turns negative. So when lambda is less than lambda c, then psi condenses, and when lambda is positive, you are in this side. So let me just give you some hand-waving justification of why this might be reasonable. When lambda is positive, this potential V looks as a minimum at psi equals zero. And if you quantize this theory, you get two normal modes, oscillation of psi this way and oscillation of psi this way. So there's two types of excitations. What are those excitations? Well, those are easy to understand from the atomic picture. The insulator was one boson per site. And locally, you can create an excitation by adding a particle or removing a particle. And they're or equally probable if you're exactly at integer filling. And so there are two types of particles, the particles and holes, and those are precisely these two normal modes. So that's one way of understanding why this is a reasonable theory. On the other hand, when I'm on the superfluid side, then the minimum is at a non-zero psi, and then there's a number of Goldstone mode, or a phonon, or a spin wave, depending on what system you're talking about, which is at zero energy at long momenta, and that's the predominant excitation. So we have these two phases in which we can understand the basic structure by simple arguments, and the ground state wave function are also very simple. In this case, they are smoothly connected to the Bose-Einstein condensate. Here it's both smoothly connected to the insulator. You put one particle in each well. So both these states are actually simple states that, in principle anyway, can be understood very well by traditional methods. So my focus right now, and what will be important for interpreting the experiment, is this particular point, the critical point where this, neither of these simple pictures works. And in this case, this turns out to be a mathematical object that's been studied in both in field theory and string theory for other reasons, something called a conformal field theory in three space-time dimensions. And one feature of this conformal field theory is that it does not have, first of all, it's an entangled state of whose entanglement we're trying to understand these days. And it also does not have simple particle-like excitations. In fact, it's probably the simplest object that we know which has these characteristics. And so it's well worth studying theoretically, and also it's nice that there are experimental realizations. CFTs in two dimensions invariably have some basis in which they look like free particles, but in three, that's not possible. So that makes it much harder to study these, but this is really the simplest context in which we can study entangled state without any quasi-particle excitations. So let me come back to the experiment. So the experiment is really shaking the system uniformly, and it's not preferring any given direction of psi. So you can see that one thing it might excite when you shake the lattice is this particular excitation, which of course should be very, very familiar to you as the Higgs particle. So there should be a Higgs particle here. However, there's one important difference from particle physics, and here, this Higgs mode actually decays very rapidly because it's very strongly coupled. This coupling U is effectively infinite. And so it decays very strongly to pairs of spin waves, to pairs of number Goldstone modes. And so when you look at it perturbatively, it's not at all clear whether this thing should survive or not. So one regime where you can actually study this quite carefully is near the conformal field theory. So the strong coupling nature of the conformal field theory has a signature in the decay of this Higgs mode and how rapidly it decays. So this is something we've studied in the last couple of years. And I summarize my result by saying that the Higgs actually does decay, but there's a ghost-like Higgs left over, which for reasons some of you will already anticipate, we call a quasi-normal mode. And one of the reasons for calling it a quasi-normal mode is that if you look at the right response function for shaking the whole lattice, that response function has a pole, but in the lower half plane. This is the second Riemann sheet of the lower half plane. And that pole is the remnant of the Higgs. And one important feature about it is that its real and imaginary part, at least for n equals 2, are roughly of the same magnitude. And we don't have any good way from analytics for determining that pole any more accurately. You really have to force to numerics, and that difficulty in identifying. So this Higgs then, or almost Higgs, is my first example of a non-quasi-particle excitation. Okay, so from this presence of this pole and various scaring arguments on what happens as you approach the conformal field theory, we can make some predictions for the experiments, which I won't go into the details. And they, in fact, are roughly consistent with what's seen over here. So this threshold here that we're identifying as the Higgs-like quasi-normal mode. We can also actually make predictions to the shape of this function, and they fit those predictions to the data, and it seems to work reasonably well. And so this is, in fact, the exponents and the scaling fit here is one of the first measurements of a quantum critical type behavior in a 2D system. So that works extremely well. And then since then, there's also been this very nice numerical work trying to figure out the full spectral function more carefully that involves some delicate analytic continuation, which they think may have mastered in some limits. So this is the kind of function that appears in this result. And this whole function and it's the way it vanishes in this threshold, this little the shoulder is the remnant of this non-quasi-particle excitation, this Higgs quasi-normal mode. And that should be compared with this type of experimental data. So here there's a much better defined peak than there is in the experiments. And we think that may have to do with inhomogeneities in experiments. But anyway, I'm sure this will be studied in much greater detail. So it's really satisfying, though, that many of the basic features of this non-quasi-particle excitation, this Higgs-like particle, are being compared to experiments here. All right, so now I want to turn to the issues that may be addressed in maybe, we hope, in the next few years in these same set of experiments, is to think about the system not in the presence of an external oscillation, but in the presence of a finite temperature. So yes, sure. Well, there is no well-defined peak in any response function. And this pole has equal, it's real and imaginary parts of the same order. They're of order one. There's no sense in which it's close to the real axis. And there may well be many other poles here that we don't fully understand, which are responsible for that peak. So we can only compute this in a certain 1 over n expansion or numerically. It was quite a non-trivial calculation to even get this pole right. Okay, but this, you know, it's almost a particle, and so I'm just starting with a baby version where we're trying to make contact with experiments too. Okay, so as I was saying, I want to turn on a finite temperature, and this is the kind of canonical phase diagram you get near second order quantum critical points with strong interactions. You get blue regions, which are you can basically think of as the ordered states or the disordered, the insulating state in this case, which are just thermally excited a little bit. And I told you about the excitations of the superfluid and the insulator. These were, you know, Gnumbu-Goldstone modes, and there are also vortices and particles and holes. And in the blue regions, you can take these quasi-particles that you well understand and then write down some traditional Boltzmann-like theory for their interactions and fluctuations. And that, you know, generally it gives a very successful description of what's going on in either of these regions. But the key point I want to emphasize is that if I'm in the middle region here, I can't do that. That is not the correct expansion at all. Here, the dominant perturbation is temperature. So I'm starting with a state which is a conformal field theory, which does not have particle-like excitations. And I want to take this ill-understood state and really understand something about it at finite temperature and understand how its excitations interact with each other and how they relax and thermalize at finite temperature. So that's an extremely difficult problem. Which has occupied me for many years in many different ways. And at least, the main tool we have from solid-state physics is the Boltzmann-like approach. So we're going to use it anyway, but we generally suspect that it may not work so well. Okay, so we really need new sorts of ideas to address this sort of dynamics in this quantum critical region. But as I said, let's just go ahead and do the Boltzmann calculation. And this is something that William just covered in the conference, so I apologize to my conference mates. So if you take a free CFD3, in this case I just took free direct fermions, then you get a delta function at zero frequency. This is the free particles, and some absorption at finite frequency. So you put in some interactions. Now you know that's not a good expansion because the particles don't exist in the first place, but let's assume you could do that. Then you put in some interaction U, which is this coupling, psi to the fourth coupling, and you expect to broaden out that peak and then get some other frequency dependence. So you get a very sharp and narrow peak at low frequencies in the regime where the theory might work. And the theory we know might work when U is very small, which is only the case when you're close to three dimensions or when the number of components of the order parameter is very large, neither of which we know is true. So that's sort of where things stood and where the best we could do by the traditional methods of solid-state physics. However, we could make some general statements just by looking at the structure of the solution. We could say that the basic frequency scale that controls dynamics in this quantum critical region is just KT, times some universal constants that are properties of the conformal field theory. And associated with these kind of relaxational phenomena, there should be, we expect, various quasi-normal modes similar to the Higgs quasi-normal mode in the lower half plane, and they're all at this some constant times kT over h bar. Also from similar types of skating arguments, you can also see that the conductivity, which I just computed, even though we can't compute it very accurately, it's just a pure number in units of Planck's constant and other numbers that you know about the system. So we would love to now compute numbers of this type, but we have no good method for accurately computing these numbers in this system with non-quasi-particle dynamics. Okay, so one, I should turn this around a little bit so I know what's coming. So there's a new method that's a new kid in town to address these issues. Oh, there it is. And I'm just going to summarize it in the next few transparencies. And it's the idea of gauge gravity duality, which grew out of string theory. And what string theory has taught us, that is, if you take a conformal field theory at non-zero temperature, which I imagine is sitting on this boundary here, that's the equivalent to theory of gravity in one higher dimension. And furthermore, so this is the higher dimension, and it has a certain metric structure called anti-de Sitter space. But when you raise the temperature of a conformal field theory, the theory in the higher dimension also acquires a horizon similar to the surface of a black hole. And then, you know, Hawking and Bekenstein taught us that the horizon has a temperature and an entropy, and the temperature and entropy of the horizon are now reinterpreted as just the same thing as the temperature and entropy of this quantum critical system. So that's a nice, satisfying observation, not yet enough to get me excited. But as many other people, including Dom Sohn especially, showed, that you can extend this correspondence to even dynamical properties. So if I take this boundary theory and say perturb it a little bit to measure its conductivity, in the gravitational picture, that's equivalent to having waves that go past the horizon of the black hole. And in fact, the normal modes of the black hole are precisely these quasi-normal modes that I've been discussing from a very different language of this quantum critical system. And it's another, when you look at the normal modes of a black hole, you also find quite naturally that the natural ring-down frequencies of the modes is just the Hawking temperature, ring-down, yeah. So that's exactly what we expected from very different considerations in the quantum critical region. So this kind of approach has been applied with, it gives you a completely different way of thinking about and computing various thermodynamic and then hydrodynamic properties of this system on the boundary. So I don't have time to or want to go through any of the technical details, but let me just show you the results of one such calculation. Let me give a little bit of the philosophy behind this approach. So we have our famous, our Bose-Hubbard model sitting here, our system of bosons, and we certainly don't know what its gravitational dual is. But we imagine that if I make every boson an n by n matrix and take some large n limit, that it might be equivalent to some theory of gravity. We don't know how to take that large n limit. It's too difficult. The large n limits we always take are of vectors, not of matrices. But I imagine there's some large n limit, and I'm eventually going to set n equals 1. Why can I get away with that? Well, it's just hope. Just in the same way in the epsilon expansion, Wilson said epsilon equals 1, and it worked, and we're hoping something like this will happen here too. So we imagine there's some dual gravitational theory, which is a good expansion for your favorite conformal field theory. And then you, not knowing that theory, you try to write down the most general action for that theory. So we're interested only in linear charge transport, And we argued in this paper that up to 4 derivatives in the effective gravitational action for linear charge transport, there's only a limited number of terms. And each one of these terms is associated with a coupling constant. But you can fix those coupling constants, assuming the validity of this theory, by matching it to various properties of the conformal field theory. So in principle, you know all the coupling constants, although they can be quite difficult to determine. Once you fix the theory by some properties of the conformal field theory, we're going to now use it at finite temperature and resum it to all orders. And when you do that, you get predictions for the physical properties. And in particular for the conductivity, you get these curves where they depend on this parameter gamma, which was a coefficient of this term over here. And furthermore, the theory tells you in many different ways that gamma has to be bounded between as less than 1/12. And so one of the reassuring features is that at the maximum possibility of gamma, the correction due to gamma is relatively small. It's about 33% at most. And so that tells you that perhaps this expansion is not totally unreasonable. We could have easily got a factor of 10 correction, but we don't. So at least at fourth order, it seems to be reasonably well behaved. Anyway, so these are the kind of predictions you get, and there are also reasons for expecting that for the Bose-Hubbard model, you are somewhere close to the maximum possible value of gamma. Okay, I'll just leave it there. I just mentioned that there was an earlier quantum Monte Carlo study by Eric Sorensen of the Bose-Hubbard model, where after some careful work on analytic continuation, he estimated that this ratio sigma of 0 to sigma of infinity was 1.36. And amazingly, that's remarkably close to the value you expect from holography near this bound. So we are, with William, we're studying this more carefully and see if you can understand this. Is this an accident or is there some deeper reason for this? And the hope here is, of course, to make further predictions about many other properties of this system. So let me summarize what I've done so far. So in the traditional condensed matter textbook way of solving for physical dynamics of many-body system, this is the recipe. If you give me your quantum many-body system, the first thing I'll do is identify the quasi-particles and their dispersions, and I suppose I know them. And then I compute the scattering matrix elements of them 2 by 2. So all of these things, I can work very hard and get them. And then I use the Boltzmann equation, which is an uncontrolled approximation, right? Boltzmann equation is valid to second order in collisions, but I'm going to resum it to all orders. And I go ahead and do that uncontrolled approximation, and I make predictions. And this, it works extremely well in the vast majority of systems. So the new approach for non-quasi-particle system via holography is that the first step fails immediately. I start with a CFT, which does not have quasi-particles. So I can't identify any quasi-particles or give you the dispersion. But I have other sets of data. I have their various critical exponents that identify which are the important set of fields. And then I have something called operator product expansion coefficient, which are analogs of scattering matrix elements, or really the fusion rules of these quasi-particles. And these also, in principle, I can compute if I work hard enough. So the new kit in town is now to take this data, and in principle, from this data, at least in principle, you can fix order by order various OPE coefficients in some gravitational various couplings in a gravitational theory. Okay, so this can be done fairly systematically, and then you in a hope and a prayer, you say, okay, let's just take this theory and solve it to all orders and see what I get. It's not justified by any small parameter, but it's really the simplest theory that obeys all the necessary conditions that you want any dynamical theory to obey. And that's involved. So you're replacing the Boltzmann equation by solving of Einstein's equation. And this is a program that many of us are trying to see through to its, see how well it can do and eventually maybe make contact with experiments. Okay, so that ends part one, where I talked about one system without quasi-particle excitation and complicated entanglement. I have about 20 minutes, is that correct? Okay, so I want to talk about a second system now, which are, of course, is the elephant in the room, which are the high-temperature superconductors. These are not conformal field theories, and I'm not going to use any gauge gravity duality, but I'm just going to review some recent experiments and tell you my thoughts on where things are going. Okay. So let me begin by talking about the phase diagram of this particular material. This is one of the better studied class of high-temperature superconductors known as the iron pnictides. And this consists of a square lattice of iron atoms with various other stuff in other layers. And to leading order, we just think of the iron atoms as being independent of the other layers. So in this particular compound, you can replace the arsenic by phosphorus. And arsenic and phosphorus are in the same column of the periodic table, so that really is not doping. It's just a way of expanding the lattice. So this is one of the unique compounds in which you can do an isoelectronic substitution and get and vary parameters without changing the degree of disorder very much and making it really quite clean. So when you do that, this is the kind of phase diagram you get as a function of x, where x is the ratio of arsenic to phosphorus. And there's various phases here that I just want to emphasize. So there's an AF phase here, an antiferromagnet. And in this case, in the sense of entanglement, it's kind of boring. It's just the spins are polarized in some definite arrangement. These are the spins on the iron sides. In this system, it happens to be also be a metal. Anyway, so whereas in the cuprates, the antiferromagnet would be in an insulating regime. Then what else do we see? Then at low temperatures, this is, of course, the big high-temperature superconductors where TC is as high as 50 Kelvin in this class of compounds. And again, all the evidence is that you can understand the superconductor, at least qualitatively, as just a Bose condensate of electron pairs. So again, not something that's entangled in the sense of get people in this conference excited. Then this black region here is a metal, and the color plot here is showing you the temperature dependence of the metal. So black means alpha is 2, means the resistivity is going as T squared, and that's the typical behavior expected in the Boltzmann-Landau theory of a metal. And so we expect this to be very well described by the independent electron paradigm. And finally, there's this regime in the middle, which is called a strange metal because that's the regime we don't understand at all. And here, the resistance goes roughly linear with temperature. And really, one of the challenges to many of us is to understand the physics of the strange metal. Now, this particular phase diagram suggests that this might be associated with quantum criticality of the loss of antiferromagnetism. And that's a point of view that I'm going to explore a bit further. But we don't have a complete theory of what's going on here at all. OK, so then the other class of superconductors are, of course, the original cuprate superconductors, like yttrium, barium, copper oxide. And their phase diagram looks a little bit different. Here you're doping, changing the hole concentration for a whole doped superconductor like YBCO. You have a much higher temperature of superconductivity. But now, as I mentioned earlier, the antiferromagnetism is actually an insulator, and it doesn't overlap the superconducting dome as much. It has much lower doping. And if you look at these metals above the superconducting critical temperature, on this side, you have what looks like a conventional metal. This is the Fermi surface of the metal, meaning that there are electrons outside and holes inside, and that's the boundary between the electrons and holes, which can be measured by photoemission. And furthermore, the area of the region with occupied electrons is equal to the electron density. So that's what you expect from Fermi liquid theory. On the other hand, in this pink region here, it's not clear what's going on. It seems rather mysterious. There's no well-defined Fermi surface. Really understanding this region is one of the big challenges in the field. And partly because of this seeming breakup of the Fermi surface, this region is called the pseudogap. And I want to actually use this opportunity to introduce some new ideas that a number of us have been working on this understanding the pseudo gap. That seems like an easier problem than understanding the strange metal, which is also present here. Okay, so let me just, as I said a bit earlier, let me focus on the nictides for now. And it seems very clear from the phase diagram, the nictides are the important ingredients, roughly speaking, is the presence of a metal which is interacting with some sort of antiferromagnet. So let's just take a very generic theory of a metal with a Fermi surface coupled to some broken symmetry of this type where you have a wave vector k, which tells you about the modulation and the spin density in the antiferromagnetic phase. So if I start with a metal and imagine that some electron, the low-energy electron, sitting on the Fermi surface, those are the active electrons, scatters off some local antiferromagnetic order. So if it scatters off the antiferromagnetism, it's going to pick up this wave vector k. So let me just take this Fermi surface and move it by wave vector k, move all of the electrons by wave vector k. And when I do that, in general, I'll end up at points that were not originally on the Fermi surface. So I may have the scattering process, but I'll end up with some high energy state, so I don't have to worry about that process in principle. But there are 8 special points, the so-called hotspots, where both the initial and final states are on the Fermi surface. And so it's reasonable to expect that this is where most of the interesting physics is going to be focused. So if I now imagine the anti-ferromagnetism actually becomes completely static, then you open up gaps at these points, and you go into a phase where you've broken the symmetry. You still have a metal, but the Fermi surface, as we say, has reconstructed. So the phase diagram of this model looks something like this. It's now similar to the superfluid insulator transition I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. There you had a broken symmetry associated with the Bose condensate. Here you also have the analog of a Bose condensate, which is this anti-ferromagnetic order. But you have something else. And the other thing that happens at the same point is the reconstruction of the Fermi surface. So there's a whole new set of low-energy excitations, which are the electrons on the Fermi surface, and they reconstruct at this point. Okay, so now many people have thought much about the fluctuations about the simple mean field picture. And for a long time, it's been understood that if you put in, go beyond the simple picture and look at the fluctuations of the antiferromagnetism, especially sitting here somewhere, that the state you'll get will be a superconductor. So roughly speaking, what happens is that these electrons sitting at these hot spots, so there's an electron here, it meets an antiferromagnetic fluctuation, and it gets scattered to this point. And its partner electron with the opposite momentum meets an antiferromagnetic fluctuation, gets scattered to that point. So the net result is this pair of electrons that gets scattered from here to there. And then as these people showed, provided the amplitude wave function of the pair changes sign between this and this, you get a net attractive interaction, which is always present and becomes stronger, in fact, as you approach the antiferromagnetic critical point. And so the conclusion is that there is D-wave superconductivity due to the attraction of these electrons, which is induced by exchanging this antiferromagnetic boson phi, which is analogous to the exchange of phonons in the old BCS theory, except the momentum and spin dependence is a little bit more complicated. Anyway, so this is the zeroth order theory for D-wave superconductivity in all of these class of high-temperature superconductors. It's a weak coupling theory, and you know, in principle, we could have declared victory immediately, but I think people really wanted to know whether this would work at stronger coupling because there are many other effects in addition to the attraction that I haven't mentioned, which are detrimental to pairing. Anyway, so this is one question that we addressed recently by quantum Monte Carlo. We came up with a way that I won't describe, a way of setting this problem of Fermi surfaces interacting with antiferromagnetic fluctuations, setting it up in a way that you could get rid of the sign problem of Monte Carlo and go across the quantum critical point from the magnetic state to the antiferromagnetic state. Sorry, the metallic state to the antiferromagnetic state at this point, RC, that's where it is. And we found very clearly that indeed near the critical point, close to it, was where the D-wave superconductivity was present. So Erez is continuing to work on this and look at further details of this. But this is, I think, one of the first pieces of evidence that even in the strong coupling limit, this system of metals interacting with antiferromagnetism does indeed have D-wave superconductivity. Okay, so if I accept that, then if I now try to draw a finite temperature phase diagram, following the analogy of the Bose-Hubbard model, I have two phases. In the Bose-Hubbard model, I had a superfluid and an insulator. Here I have a spin density wave or an antiferromagnet and a metal with different Fermi surface structure. In a similar way, I can imagine some quantum critical region. Perhaps this is the strange metal. But there's another effect I have to consider, because as I just showed you, right near this critical point, actually, there has to be superconductivity. So just qualitatively, you might want to draw this phase diagram as what happens at an antiferromagnetic critical point. It's not too far off of what's seen in the system. So at least for the nictides and perhaps the electron dope cuprates, this is a pretty good starting point. I mean, I feel confident that it is. Okay, but this is really very different from something like YVCO, where the antiferromagnetism really is at much lower doping, and there is this pseudo gap that everyone's interested in. So in the remaining, 5 minutes, I want to say a little bit about our recent ideas on how this theory can be extended to also get the pseudo gap physics. So I'm actually going to go back to something that Oops, okay, let me summarize what I'm going to show you. Yeah, so this is the main conclusion if I don't get to it. So what we show that for metals near an antiferromagnetic ordering transition, there's an additional emergent symmetry, which you call a pseudospin symmetry. And the pseudospin symmetry maps the D-wave superconductor to another kind of charge density wave, which we call an incommensurate D-wave bond loader. I'll describe what that is. And this pseudospin doublet and fluctuations of it is what's responsible for the pseudogap phase. So one implication of this is that any time you have antiferromagnetic mediated pairing, if the coupling is strong enough, there's always this additional order parameter. You can't get rid of it. Anytime you have a metal which has antiferromagnetic mediated pairing, in addition to D-wave pairing, there's a nearly degenerate competing order parameter, which is like a partner in some more higher dimensional space of order parameters. And the fluctuation in that higher dimensional space is what leads to the pseudogap region. And there's been a number of recent papers that have studied this idea. But let me introduce this idea, actually going back to a very old idea at the very beginning of high TC days. So this was an observation, I guess, partly by Affleck et al, for example, who pointed out a certain property of the exchange interaction in the insulator. So if you take the insulator, which is present at zero doping, that's just nearest neighbor exchange. It doesn't have to be any kind of exchange interaction. You can rewrite the system by introducing these NMBU coordinates between up and down spins, C up and C down dagger, and rewrite it this way. So now only the spin indices have been written explicitly, but the NMBU index is not written at all. So what this is roughly saying is that I can think of each, if I have one electron per site in the insulator, I can think of it as, you know, electrons with exchange interaction. I can think of them with holes with exchange interaction. The coupling is the same. It doesn't matter whether I think of it electrons or holes. So there's a SU2 pseudospin symmetry. What happened to my, there we go. You can rotate each psi by an arbitrary SU2 matrix and not change the Hamiltonian. In fact, you can rotate each psi by a different SU2 matrix, which depends on the site I. So it's, in fact, even a gauge symmetry. It's a huge symmetry, which is just a consequence of having just one electron per site. And this gauge symmetry was really important in especially work by Xiaogang Wen and others in classifying and understanding various spin liquid ground state of HJ. However, once you dope the system and you add this TIJ, this gauge symmetry is completely broken, or it seems to be completely broken. But you know, they argue that there might be remnant consequences in some doped spin liquid states. So what I want to mention today is the idea that it has some relationship to this. But the key point is that the half-fill system is not a spin liquid. So why should I worry about a doped spin liquid? The half-fill system is a Nail state. And now I want to dope the Nail state and then ask if there's any remnant of the pseudospin symmetry, and it turns out that there is. So there's an infinite number of SU2s, and I'll find that four of them survive in a certain regime. So how does that work? Let me go back to this phase diagram of a large Fermi surface reconstructing and focus on this side. So the antiferromagnetism is way to the left now. I'm focusing on the metal with antiferromagnetic interactions. And those are strongest at these 8 points. So let me just take those 8 points and zoom into one of them and ask for what's the low energy theory near those 8 points. So that's where the antiferromagnetism is predominantly acting. So that theory was written down by Abunov and Chubukov, and I won't write it down. Well, I guess I'll show it to you explicitly. There it is. It's some complicated theory of fermions with linear dispersion coupled to this order parameter via this Yukawa-type coupling. It turns out this theory has exact pseudospin symmetry. And it's actually pseudospin to the power 4, SU2 to the power 4, because there's 8 of these hotspots. So for every pair, there's an SU2. So the low energy theory of an antiferromagnetic metal, in fact, has a remnant of 4 of these SU2s that were present in the insulator. In the insulator, there was an infinite number of these SU2 because of the gauge symmetry. Here, there's a global symmetry of just 4 of them. So now you can naturally ask, what's the consequence of this SU2 to the 4 symmetry? Now, we've all agreed, and I supported Monte Carlo evidence, that this antiferromagnetic metal is actually a D-wave superconductor. So let me take this D-wave superconductor and apply the symmetry operation to it. So if this is about to appear, other things will also appear. Now, of course, I can do a particle transformation on all of them. That doesn't give me anything special. But I should do the particle transformation on half of them. Then I'll get a new state. And in particular, if I do them on these two but not these two, you see you get a charge density wave autoparameter, a particle hole pair, not a particle-particle pair. And this particle hole pair is such that it's at this 2kF wave vector, and its amplitude changes sign when you go from this direction to that direction. So that's sort of that's what I call incommensurate D-wave Born order. Now, why am I calling it a Born order? So here's another way to think about this new order parameter that's a pseudo-spin partner of the D-wave superconductor. Just consider some arbitrary two-point correlation function of charge zero, a particle in a hole, spin singlet at site I and J. So if I'm in some charge density wave, there's some modulation in the wave vector Q. I make that modulation the average coordinate. But then there could be an arbitrary function of the relative coordinate. This is the internal wave function of the particle hole pair. And that I can write in momentum space as a function of delta Q of K. And for generic Q, this I can expand in various functions as a function of, of K, cosines and, if I'm assuming time reversal, there's only cosines and cosines of multiple angles. Now, in all our calculations, and we've done a number of them, which I don't have any time to show you, what we find is that the dominant coefficient here for general value of Q, for a whole range of Q, is the D1. And it's dominant for the same reason that the D-wave superconductivity is dominant. That's where there's an attractive interaction when you scatter between the hotspots. The usual charge density wave would be Cs equals non-zero, and people normally don't worry about this. So because if this was the only term, you can see from here, there's in fact no charge density wave, because if I put Ri equals Rj, and this is a cosine, the sum over K gives me zero. So it's non-zero only on nearest neighbors, not on the same side. So that's why it's a bond density wave. Anyway, so this is a picture of what it looks like. I guess I'm running out of time. So that's the partner order parameter to the D-wave superconductor. So there have been many, many past instances where people have had roughly the same idea, that there should be something which is partner to the rotated from the D-wave superconductor. But I claim this is the correct way to do the rotation. Because there is a limit where it's exact in the metal, and it gives you this Born ordered state. And in fact, by moving by reciprocal lattice vector, you get a density wave at this direction. You can also get it at that direction. And Efetov et al. Have argued that it's fluctuations of this multi-component order parameter involving both D-wave pairing and D-wave Born order is what gives you the pseudo gap. So everything looks great. On the other hand, there have been a number of experiments now looking for charge order and seeing charge order in high temperature, in the pseudo gap regime. And at low temperatures, what they see, however, is this particular order. So we've also studied this order, and in the simplest theory, it's not the preferred state. But there are additional effects that we can add which make it reasonable that might be the correct wave vector. But in any case, it's always the case that the ordering is Born and has this D-wave structure. Anyway, so I'll just sketch a few experiments. So the first place this kind of Born ordering was seen, although it wasn't known to be Born ordering, was probably this experiment of Jenny Hoffman, where she saw this checkerboard-like structure around the cores of vortices in BISCO. But more recently, the same ordering has been seen, or very close to related ordering, I should say, in YVCO. And the reason YVCO is so important is that's the purest crystal with one of the highest TCs. And it's the one that shows these quantum oscillations. It's this crystal everyone's been trying to study. And now there's a great deal of evidence that it's this charge order that's responsible for the Fermi surface reconstruction in YVCO. So here's one of the recent experiments by Dave Hawthorne here. And as he said, by looking at the polarization dependence of the X-ray scattering at roughly this wave vector, that wave vector, he concluded that it has a predominantly valence bond type interpretation. Here's an X-ray scattering data which looks, I think Dave has similar data, which looks at the effect of a magnetic field. So you see this is a correlation length of about 10 lattice spacings. You see the charge order correlations become large. And when you hit TC, they become down again. So you have this order starting to develop, and then superconductivity takes over. It tilts over in the superconducting direction. But if you apply a magnetic field of 17 tesla, it keeps going and is present down to low temperatures. This is NMR data showing direct evidence for charge order at high fields, exactly where the quantum oscillations are seen. And there's several other experiments all in the last few years, all in the last year, which are all agreeing now that the important companion order in this regime of YVCO, where you have the quantum oscillations, and is in fact this charge order. And we have specific predictions now of the detailed structure of that charge order. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. So I've talked about two different systems. I went through many, many different topics here. The first experiment was the Kagome, which is a system with quasi-particle dynamics. Then I talked about the Bose-Hubbard model at its quantum critical point, or more generally, at the topic of studying conformal quantum matter. And there, especially in 2+1 dimensions, it poses a strong coupling problem where traditional methods of condensed matter are not terribly accurate. And we are certainly getting interesting and very physically reasonable results from these methods of gauge gravity duality. These methods, in principle, can also be extended to many other types of phenomena that could be explored in the experiments involving non-equilibrium physics. And then in the second part, I talked about the anti-ferromagnetic quantum critical point in the metal. We don't have a complete theory of that critical point. It's a strongly coupled point. It's not a conformal point. But we are understanding various aspects of it. And one of the aspects that actually came up in my work with Max Mitlitsky was the point that this theory has an emergent pseudo-spin symmetry. And that seems to link very naturally to all the observed charge density wave orders that are being seen in the pseudo-gap regime in the last year in the cuprates. So thank you very much.
So we like to let students have the first chance for questions. So if there's any students that have questions.
Could you elaborate just a little bit on the Monte Carlo sign problem you were mentioning?
Sure. Thanks. So I presume you know what is the sign problem?
Okay. I mean, I'm familiar with like the very basics, but if you could talk a little bit about like how you got around it and...
Yeah, oh, sure, I'd be glad to. This is also work with Erez, who's somewhere in the audience. If you take a quantum system of fermions or even bosons and you try to write them as a path integral and you want to evaluate that Feynman path integral by just counting paths in a computer, you'll find that the paths come both with positive and negative and indeed in complex weights. And so in quantum Monte Carlo, that's almost impossible to resum. So the trick always is to find some representation, some basis in which you can show that all paths have positive weights, or resum some of them in some clever way that you're only summing positive numbers when you're doing your Monte Carlo simulation. So at half filling, you know, for certain system, like the Bose-Hubbard model at half filling that I mentioned earlier, you can get around, it does not have the sign problem. But the second system, which is metal near antiferromagnetic transition, does. So the way we got around it was actually very much use this idea of hotspots. So the point, as I showed this picture a lot, you had these Fermi surface with 8 hotspots. Well, let me just draw 2 of them, which are connected by the wave vector k. And you had, say, a fermion here, psi 1, and a fermion here, psi 2. And so there was a process where psi 1, this scattered from, you went from psi 1 to psi 2, so sigma alpha beta, psi 2. And then you had an order parameter phi, which was dotted into this. So this was the basic interaction vertex. It's like a Yukawa coupling. You have some boson, or like think of a phonon. A phonon comes in and scatters at 2, okay? That's the theory that we want to. And